Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really pivotal Fourth Circuit case from 2010, United States v. Chester.
That's right.
We've gone through our sources to bring you the essentials on a question that, well, it keeps shaping how we understand the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
When can individuals with, you know, domestic violence misdemeanor convictions be restricted from owning firearms? This case, it really laid down a marker for how courts evaluate these challenges.
It did. And Chester isn't just about one person's situation. It goes right to the heart of who counts as being protected by the Second Amendment, especially when there's domestic violence in the picture. It kind of forced the courts to figure out where that line is.
Exactly. And for you listening, getting a handle on the framework from Chester is, well, it's crucial if you want to understand the ongoing debates around gun control. It's a real building block for making sense of current Second Amendment law. So let's dive into the specifics of Chester's situation.
Okay. So William Samuel Chester Jr., he was convicted back in 2005 of a misdemeanor domestic assault in West Virginia.
A misdemeanor, okay.
Right. Then, a few years later, 2008, he gets hit with federal charges. This was under 18 U.S.C. Section 922 to G9 for having firearms. That federal law, it specifically prohibits firearm possession by anyone convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence.
So the central conflict here really boils down to this. Does permanently stopping someone with that kind of misdemeanor conviction from owning guns violate their Second Amendment rights? And like we said, it's important we're talking misdemeanors, not felony.
That's a really vital distinction. And the timing here is also pretty significant. The indictment against Chester, it came in 2008, the very same year the Supreme Court handed down the big Heller decision.
Heller, right.
Yeah, and as you probably remember, Heller affirmed that individuals have a right to bear arms for self-defense at home, but it deliberately left a lot of questions unanswered about how far firearm regulations could go.
Right. Heller gave us the right, but not really the edges of that right. So when Chester challenged these charges, how did the first court, the district court, handle it?
Well, the district court, they took a fairly firm line. They basically put people with misdemeanor domestic violence convictions in the same bucket as convicted felons. Mm-hmm. They argued that restricting their guns was a presumptively lawful measure, you know, under the ideas in Heller. Faced with that, Chester pled guilty, but conditionally. That way, he kept his right to appeal the constitutional question up to the Fourth Circuit. And that's where things get really interesting for us.
Okay, so Chester appeals to the Fourth Circuit, and they didn't just rubber stamp the lower court's view. They actually set up a specific way to analyze these Second Amendment challenges. What did that look like?
Yeah, the Fourth Circuit came up with what's now a pretty well-known two-step analysis. This framework has become really significant for how courts look at Second Amendment cases.
Okay, two steps.
Step one asks, is the conduct being regulated here its firearm possession by someone with a misdemeanor domestic violence conviction? Is that conduct protected by the Second Amendment looking at it historically?
And what did the Fourth Circuit find on that first step? Was there a clear history for or against this kind of restriction?
Well, interestingly, they didn't actually make a final call on that. They sort of assumed, just for the sake of the argument, that the conduct was protected.
Oh, okay.
They basically said the historical record on this specific issue, you know, disarming people with this type of conviction, was kind of ambiguous, unclear.
So they sidestepped the historical deep dive, assumed protection, and moved on to the second step, which was...
Exactly. Step two asks, if the Second Amendment does apply, what level of legal scrutiny should the court use to evaluate the law itself, Section 922 G9?
Right, the level of scrutiny. That's always key.
It is. And this is where the court made a really pivotal classification. They decided that Chester, because of his misdemeanor domestic violence conviction, fell outside the core of the Second Amendment right. That core, according to Heller, belongs to law-abiding citizens.
Okay, so he's not considered part of that core group. How did that classification affect the legal standard they used?
It made a huge difference. Instead of using strict scrutiny, which is the toughest standard, demanding a compelling government interest and a narrowly tailored law, the court decided to apply intermediate scrutiny.
Intermediate scrutiny, okay.
Yeah, which is still demanding, but less so than strict. It requires the government to show a substantial government interest and that the law has a reasonable fit with achieving that interest.
Got it. So the framework is set. Two-step test. Intermediate scrutiny, because Chester's outside the core. Now, how did the government's case actually hold up under that standard? I seem to remember they hit a snag initially.
That's right. So under intermediate scrutiny, the government had to show two main things. First, a substantial government interest. Second, a reasonable fit between the law banning guns for this group and that interest.
The substantial government interest part seems pretty straightforward here, doesn't it? Preventing domestic gun violence, that's obviously important.
Oh, absolutely. The court had no trouble agreeing that the government has a compelling substantial interest in preventing domestic violence and, you know, the terrible outcomes when firearms are involved. The problem came with the second part, the reasonable fit.
So the goal was clear, but proving this specific law was the right tool for the job, that was harder.
Exactly. The government brought in general statistics about domestic violence deaths, which, while tragic and serious, didn't specifically show that people convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence were significantly more likely to commit future gun violence.
They needed that specific link.
Precisely. They hadn't really shown why a permanent ban on firearms for this particular group was a reasonably tailored solution to the overall problem.
So the court was basically saying, we get the problem, but you haven't given us enough hard evidence that this law, applied to this group, actually works effectively to solve it.
That's a perfect summary. The court was quite explicit, saying things like anecdotes and supposition just weren't enough for intermediate scrutiny. They needed real empirical proof showing that Section 922 OSHE-2 effectively reduced gun violence, stemming specifically from individuals with these misdemeanor convictions.
It really emphasizes the need for data-driven arguments when justifying these kinds of laws. But wasn't there another judge who had a slightly different take in a concurring opinion?
Yes, that's right. Judge Davis wrote a concurrence. He agreed with the outcome, sending the case back, but his reasoning was different. He argued, more directly, that anyone with a history of domestic violence, even if it's just a misdemeanor, simply isn't law-abiding in the sense Heller meant.
So under his view?
Under his view, they wouldn't even really get the full Second Amendment protection in the first place, making the ban much easier to justify, possibly even without needing stricter intermediate scrutiny.
That really highlights the ongoing struggle, doesn't it? Different ways to read Heller and apply it to these specific situations. It wasn't a totally unified decision, even on the reasoning.
Not at all. It shows that even with Supreme Court guidance like Heller, figuring out how the Second Amendment applies to different people and different gun laws is still, you know, a really complex and contested legal area.
Okay, so the case gets sent back down. What are the big lasting impacts of this Fourth Circuit decision in Chester? What should we really take away from it today?
Well, there are a few key things. First, Chester definitely put a significant burden on the government. When gun control laws face Second Amendment challenges, especially under intermediate scrutiny, the government can't just point to general safety goals. They have to build a solid evidentiary case.
So they need the data, the proof, that the specific law works for the specific group it targets.
Exactly. Second, the case really reinforces this idea of tiered Second Amendment rights. The level of scrutiny a gun law gets isn't the same for everyone. It depends on whether the court sees the person affected as part of that core group of law-abiding citizens. If you're outside that core, the government might have more room to regulate.
And third, you mentioned the history part earlier. How did Chester influence that aspect?
Well, while the Chester court itself kind of punted on the deep historical dive in step one, it highlighted that lower courts need to wrestle with both the historical understanding from around the founding era and contemporary evidence about a law's effectiveness and fit when they're looking at modern gun regulations.
So it's this blend of history and modern data both playing a role. And you also mentioned this connects to more recent cases.
Oh, absolutely. Major recent cases like United States v. Rahimi just last year, dealing with firearm restrictions for people under domestic violence, restraining orders, they build directly on the kind of legal framework laid out in Chester. The courts are still dealing with these same fundamental questions. Who can be banned from having guns, and what proof is needed.
It's pretty amazing how a case from, 2010 still echoes so strongly today in these huge Second Amendment battles. So as we wrap up this deep dive on United States v. Chester, what's maybe a key question the case leaves us with?
I think a really central question Chester brings up is this. When deciding if a gun law is constitutional, should we lean more on modern statistics showing if it actually works to save lives, or should we focus more on finding historical parallels from back when the Bill of Rights was written? Chester kind of tried to do both, but that tension, still right there.
Yeah, that tension between the empirical, data-driven approach and the originalist, historical approach.
Yeah.
Seems like that's the crux of so many Second Amendment arguments now, especially after the Supreme Court's Bruin decision really doubled down on the historical analysis part.
Precisely. It's a constant balancing act. And maybe a final thought for our listeners. Think about how that two-step framework from Chester and the use of intermediate scrutiny might play out with other kinds of gun laws. What sort of evidence, historical or modern, would you need to see to uphold or strike down, say, restrictions on assault weapons or high-capacity magazines? It forces you to think about how courts actually make these incredibly difficult decisions.